This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many of the greatest cartoonists of the 20th century were published in the New Yorker magazine, which is one reason why many New Yorker readers over the decades have turned first to the cartoons. Every cartoon ever published in the magazine since its 1925 debut, that's a total of 68,647 cartoons, are collected in the Complete Cartoons of the New Yorker. It's a book and double CD collection. Today we'll be hearing from several cartoonists featured in the collection, Bruce Eric Kaplan, Gayon Wilson, Roz Chast, and my first guest, Robert Mankoff, who also edited the collection. He's been the magazine's cartoon editor since 1997. He got the job 20 years after he sold his first cartoon to The New Yorker. Mankoff edited several earlier collections of the magazine's cartoons, including its 75th anniversary collection. He's also the founder and editor of the internet cartoon database, The Cartoon Bank. I spoke with him in 2002 after the publication of his book, The Naked Cartoonist, about the art and craft of cartooning. Robert Mankoff, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm going to ask you to describe your most famous cartoon.
All right, well, here is my most famous cartoon. It's quite simple, and maybe that accounts for its fame. There's a guy on the phone. He's an executive, clearly a busy executive. He's pointing to his Rolodex, and he's got his phone to his ear, and he's saying, "No, Thursday's out. How about never? Is never good for you?" I know from statistics assiduously compiled that's my favorite cartoon, because that's the one people license the most, that's the one they buy prints of, and that's the one when I'm at a party and they say, "You know what cartoon of yours I like best?" And I say, I do know what it is, and I tell them that, and I'm right.
Why do you think it struck a chord?
I think it was in 1993, and it seemed to sort of symbolize just that, the hectic, harried nature of our lives, where we're constantly meeting and associating with people which we often don't want to associate with, and we're trying to obfuscate and say the polite thing, and this somehow was really saying what people were really thinking on some of these phone calls.
You became the cartoon editor of The New Yorker in 1997. Why don't you just describe what the job is?
It's an interesting job. It's not, I guess, what people think. Often when I go around and I give talks or people find out I'm a cartoon editor, they said, "Well, that's the greatest job in the world." Imagine it, that it's something like, I don't know, being a candy taster, you know, or eating all the best food, you know, the food you really love. And it's a great job because I love cartoons, but the process by which, well, I'll give you for an example, like on a normal week, I will see 34 or 40 contributors to the magazine who do cartoons, and I'll see cartoons that unsolicited and solicited cartoons, you know, by mail. I might look at 1,000 cartoons in 2 days. So when I'm looking at the cartoons, it's probably taking me about 10 seconds or less to look at each cartoon, and at that point, just in a preliminary way, decide, do we want to use it? Do I like it? Is there something there? And then I'm going to go back and look at them again. But I'm not laughing, or almost rarely. I'm sort of just processing. There's so much to look at. And if I went on sort of some sort of gut instinct, like, am I laughing at the cartoon? Well, it would be sort of like if you were tasting bonbons and you were trying to judge them and you were saying, "Gee, this 1,000th bonbon, why doesn't it taste as good as the 5th? It wouldn't make any sense. So I try to bring some sort of principles to just the initial selection of the cartoons. Then after I make a selection out of about 1,000 of maybe 50 cartoons that I then take in an art meeting and I show to David Remnick, and we have baskets, yes, no, and maybe. And then David and I, and sometimes
he's the editor of The New Yorker.
The editor of The New Yorker basically choose the cartoons. And in the end, David chooses them. He's got to pick out of these bunch which ones he thinks makes overall sense for the magazine. And we have differences of opinion. And, you know, sometimes he gives in to me, but he's usually the editor, so he usually gets his way.
So you have to have criteria because, as you said, the 1,000th bonbon isn't as tasty as the first. So what are your criteria? Could you put it into words?
Sure. Well, the first criteria I have for the cartoon is Is it communicating some idea through the medium of humor? Is it demonstrating, you know, not just funniness, but thinking? Is it making some point? And of course, we do cartoons that are just silly and just funny. But overall, I think the enduring nature of the New Yorker cartoons is that they strike a chord in someone. People remember them because they make some sort of point. So I'm looking for that, the communication of an idea. Secondly, if it's someone who's new, I'm looking, do they have a distinctive voice? You know, are they doing their own cartoons, or are they, you know, did they basically see a Raj Chass cartoon and think, oh, I can do Raj Chass cartoons? And then thirdly, whether or not how funny the cartoon is not, to me, always the ultimate criteria. Is, for example, if a cartoon is on a topic that's been beaten to death, then it's got to be very funny. While if it's on some topic that's never been discussed before for the first time, then as far as I'm concerned, I'll say, well, yeah, let's use this cartoon. No one has ever done a cartoon about the fact that men don't like hair on their back or whatever it is.
What's the editing process like? Do you work with cartoonists on improving the work, or making it funnier, changing the drawing?
Well, very little, because one of the things is that the cartoonists submit 10 or 15 ideas every week, and it's a little bit like a type of haiku. You know what I mean? You can fiddle with it a little bit. But one of the things especially that's evolved in the New Yorker cartoon is this idea of authenticity. The cartoons, I would say, I mean, everything else in the magazine goes through a very, very elaborate editing process where things get written and rewritten. And, of course, it's still the person's work, but there's often a lot of hands in it. Here, you know, when you're looking at Roz Chast's cartoon, it's Roz Chast. Nobody else wrote the line for her. Every once in a while, I'll make a suggestion, like with someone like Roz, if there's many panels, I'll say something like, you know, I think panel 4 is weak. You know, I think you could do a little bit more. It's more of encouragement. The people are very talented, and they want to come up with their ideas. See, in a caption, let's say, 10 or 15 words, yeah, we'll change a word, but I don't want to really start rewriting it because then it becomes my work. And one of the things about the New Yorker cartoon, and when you're looking at it, it says, is it really the work of the person who does it. The editing, I think, primarily is in the selection and really in the criteria. It was very different at one time. When the magazine started out in the 30s and 40s, there was a lot more, not so much editing, but it's straight-out gag writing. People like Peter Arno, for the most part, didn't write any of their captions, or Helen Hokanson. Very, very few. So it might be one writer. It might be more like sort of a Broadway show model where someone does the music and someone, you know, does the lyrics.
So someone would come up with a gag and then the cartoonist would be brought in to come up with the image?
Yeah, but more collaborative than that.
They worked as teams.
But the roles were clearly assigned. Helen Hokanson might draw pictures and talk with her collaborator, and he might come up with lines, and they might go back and forth. But it was different than it is now.
Who were some of your heroes when you were reading The New Yorker before you started working there?
Well, I, like everybody else, Charles Adams and George Price. But I would say my main influence, although my cartoon certainly veered very, very far away from it, was Saul Steinberg. There was something so, and it was hardly to say even that they were cartoons, but there was something sort of so deeply intellectual about those cartoons, and I had quit graduate school to become a cartoonist, so Saul Steinberg was sort of my way station.
Can you give an example of one of his cartoons that influenced you?
Well, I think I'm trying to remember it. He engaged in this wonderful sort of, you know, almost fake writing, very elaborate writing. And there's a guy quite simple cartoon. It's a loan office, and there's this guy asking for the loan, and in the speech balloon that's coming out is all this elaborate writing, but it's all just shaped like a no. Almost like the Constitution, you know,
right.
But in this wonderful, and also, you know, and also very, very artistic as well. And the elaborate pictures that really can't be summarized on the radio would just sort of spark my imagination and think, I guess what it made me think is that this was something you could aspire to, that something wonderful could be done in this field, that it could be more than just a joke or more than, I had grown up drawing Donald Duck and Bugs Bunny in school, and it could sort of be... I quit graduate school and I said, well, gee, the New Yorker could sort of be the Harvard of cartooning.
Now, you sold your first cartoon to the New Yorker in 1977. What were some of the things that you drew before that didn't get in, that got your rejection notices?
Yeah, I did hundreds of cartoons, and I actually got a number of them published. I'm thinking of some of them now. One of them is in the book. It shows a jester, and he's in a very gloomy cell. He's hanging by his hands, and he's peering out the window to the guard, and it's a court jester, and he's saying, "Please tell the king I've remembered the punchline."
Yeah, I like that one.
A middle-aged couple. They're just reading the paper in the living room. And you see in the picture says it's not someone's knocking at the door, and the woman is saying to the man, "Quick, hide! That may be my husband."
That's a kind of variation on the no sex theme.
Right, it is. Yeah, it is. And when I look back on this, I mean, sometimes I flip that around, where you take a situation that is a very, very common situation, and then by somehow looking at it in a different way, like I might have a couple just at breakfast, reading the paper, drinking coffee, and the woman might be saying, "Dave, I think the divorce has just been a little bit too amiable."
Now, in talking about rejection notices, in your new book, The Naked Cartoonist, you reprint a letter you got from David Mamet shortly after you became cartoon editor, and then you print the note you sent him in return.
Right.
So read us the two.
Well, David Mamet, I'll do this from memory. I think it's pretty close.
This is David Mamet, the screenwriter and playwright
director. Right, the screenwriter. Well, and cartoonist, I guess, because he did cartoons, and I think he has published some cartoons. He sent me, when I became cartoon editor, Dear Mr. Mankoff, congratulations on becoming cartoon editor. I've taken the liberty of sending you a bunch of cartoons. And I looked at them, and I wrote him back this note saying, "Thanks very much. I've taken the liberty of sending you a play."
Why did you do that?
Just snottiness. But partly
because it's really a way of saying to him, you may be a great writer, but your cartoons aren't very good. I mean,
let's put it more gently, not right for us. That's what I learned basically in being an editor. You don't say things are not good; you say they're not right for us.
Right.
But there is a certain arrogance that writers have, often captured when they say this to you. "I can't draw at all, but..." Their assumption is somehow that they could easily, create great cartoons because they're smart, they're writers, they're funny, and whatnot. And I haven't found it to be the case. Now, last week, Norman Mailer was in my office showing me his cartoons. And I must say, I was a lot nicer to Mr. Mailer than I was in this note to David Mamet. But... they weren't actually cartoons, so I don't know if they didn't really fit the criteria so much, whereas actually David Mamet's cartoons were basically attempts to do gag cartoons. And, I judge them as unsuccessful. Others might think otherwise. I think the problem writers have, and even, great writers, is that they bring all... It's almost like a tremendously muscle-bound person trying to play ping pong. They just bring in too much to it.
Mm-hmm.
They want to show off. They want to show not only are they funny, but they're smart. The other thing that happens, I don't know how to describe this, but even if their cartoons were okay, it would be hard to use them because the cartoons are become too contaminated by their other persona, so that people couldn't really even see the cartoon. The way I'd explain it is, sort of by flipping it and say, let's say you look at Rozchak's cartoons and if you look at them for 20 years and these wonderful cartoons, and then you meet Rozchak. Well, it's hard for you just to meet Roz. you're looking at her, but you're not even seeing her, or you are, so you're seeing her, but it's somehow contaminated by all your preconceptions about her because of her cartoons.
In a recent edition of The New Yorker, there's a cartoon that's very funny. I thought I'd ask you about it. As our listeners may know, there's a new Museum of Sex in New York, and this cartoon showed exhibits from the Museum of No Sex, and the exhibits included the chastity belt, the headache, the pocket protector, Star Trek memorabilia, and late night television. Talk about deciding to use this particular comic.
Well, I mean, I think, in a way, it's sort of like a common way to flip an idea. And another criteria really that I didn't mention is topicality. A cartoon like this, simply because it talks about this new subject, in a way, doesn't have to be the world's best cartoon. It just sort of interestingly flipped the idea of sex with no sex. I mean, one of the things that changed somewhat in The New Yorker, especially when Tina Brown started being editor, was that sex became a topic. One of the first cartoons I did when Tina became editor for her tenure was, there was a couple, a middle-class couple in bed, and they're reading, and the woman is saying, you're right, tonight isn't reading night, tonight is sex night.
Right.
In a way, both these cartoons have an affinity. One of the things is that, in sort of a subtextual way, this cartoon speaks to the fact that although we have a very sexualized culture, people aren't having much sex.
Well, you have another cartoon about that, and it's there's four middle-aged people in a living room. One's sitting on the couch, one's on an easy chair, another's on another easy chair. One's reading, one's listening to a Walkman, the other's knitting.
Right.
And what's the caption?
I think it's Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, the remake.
Yeah. And for anyone who doesn't know that movie, that's a movie about like swinging couples having sex with each other in the 60s or 70s, I forget which. So yeah, I thought that was another funny one on that same theme, not having sex.
Not having sex, and this is a little bit what I'm talking about as we're discussing these cartoons. You can see what the sort of bedrock criteria for what has become defined as a New Yorker cartoon is. It's topical, but it's not today topical. It's not this week topical. It's contemporary, but it is speaking to the issues of this time.
Can you think of funny ones about having sex?
About having sex. Let me say, I think I did a cartoon where there's a few cartoons. One I did where there's a woman and a man in bed, and they're actually having sex, New Yorker type sex. sometimes I ask my wife, "You want to have New Yorker type sex or regular sex?" But the woman is saying to the man, "Wow, our first date, and already I feel like our second. It's our second."
Right. After September 11th, how long did it take The New Yorker to feel like it was comfortable or that it was appropriate to publish cartoons that had to do with terrorism?
I think we took a week where we just stepped back. We had one George Booth drawing, which wasn't a cartoon, sort of an anti-cartoon. It just showed one of his usually gay, happy figures depressed. Miss Ritterhouse, she had her violin, but she wasn't playing any music, and the cat just had the head between his hands. But the week after, we sort of edged back into it. The first cartoon we ran after September 11th was a woman saying to a guy at a bar, saying, I never thought I'd laugh again until I saw that jacket. it's got and it showed wonderfully. It showed wonderfully, really well. We were going to laugh. People were going to be silly and stupid. And then there was a great cartoon, which is still applicable, is that woman getting on a plane with a cat and a little cat carrier, and a security guy saying, "Ma'am, we're going to have to declaw the cat."
That's good.
So I think we did a pretty good job. Of course, it wasn't about. We didn't do cartoons about the tragic part of it. We did cartoons about the human part and what we were after September 11th, which were still people.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. Whenever you get to New York, come and visit me at The New Yorker. I'd love to show you the place.
I'm glad you said that because I have a few cartoons I wanted to show you. I'm kidding. Don't worry.
And I have a few interviews, of course, I'd like to do.